Hello, gentle listener. What follows is an exploration of a whole world of everyday practices, arguably magical practices, and objects, arguably magical objects, from the East Roman realm, from late antiquity down to the very end of that. We're delighted to speak with Alicia Walker, whose work as a historian of magic has brought into focus precisely the sorts of everyday addressative ritual practices and objects, which we don't find in the learned magic books that were the focus of the last episode. But Alicia Walker is a professor of art history, and so she has a wealth of knowledge of the rich dossier of materia magica, talismanic paraphernalia, magical tools, incantation amulets, magical rings, and more, which survive from the medieval Roman world. So part one of this episode, which you're about to hear, is, in my opinion, a fascinating introduction to a host of matters which will interest students of Western esotericism and lovers of magic and have a bearing on what we think of as magic and the question of everyday esotericism, right? Esotericism of the common people. Part two, however, will be something special. An audiovisual tour of a wealth of beautiful and strange, often unexpected items from East Rome, most of which, or all of which, are magical items. Come for the discussion, stay for the magical rings in glorious full color, and now join me and Alicia Walker in making the everyday esoteric. Hello, this is Earl Fontenelle. This is the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast, and today we are speaking with Alicia Walker, professor of history of art at Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania, and a woman who knows a thing or two about all manner of matters magical from the East Roman world and the Islamicate Commonwealth and points further afield. Alicia, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Much appreciated.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here.
So in episode 217 of the podcast, we talked about these literate magical manuals, the sort of what we might want to call East Roman grimoires, if we want to be speaking loosely using this Western European term. And we did say in that episode that this is the book learned stuff, but this isn't really a picture of what we might want to call magic in the East Roman world in any complete way. This is just these very interesting texts that survive that will have been limited in their applicability to literate people, people with access to manuscripts, so of a tiny, tiny little sliver of the population. And in this episode, I wanted to talk about everything else with you, because you've taken a broad sort of art historical approach to materia magica across the whole Eastern Roman world, across time, and you can tell us more about magic in everyday life, the sort of non-fancy, non-literate, non-clerical sort of stuff.
Sure.
So I guess the first question is, whenever we're talking about magic, I don't want to get into that whole, you know, what is magic as a second order term debate, but what we can ask is, what are the polemics around magic in East Rome looking like? Because we are in very much in the heart of Orthodoxy, this state that is, it is a Christian res publica. It's sort of, its whole political raison d'etre is a sort of Christian, Roman, Greco-Roman fusion. And Christianity from very early on is very anti-magic, but what that means exactly can vary from place to place and time to time. So can you talk a little bit about what we see from the sources of sort of anti-magic polemic, and what do people mean by magia, goetia, etc.?
We will be talking about what would essentially be the medieval period of the Eastern Roman Empire, which we could say begins maybe around the 9th century. But what's important to recognize is that a lot of the discussion in that more medieval period from the 9th century to, say, the 13th century, a lot of that discussion is still looking back to the earlier Byzantine era and the early Christian era, so the patristic era, the era of the early church fathers. So in the medieval period, they're still looking back to what at that juncture was hundreds of years earlier, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, well, 9, yeah, sure, even 900 years earlier. because those early church fathers are really seen as authoritative.
Yeah.
Throughout, till the present day, right? Throughout the all divisions of Christianity. And the early church fathers are emerging into this Roman, for lack of better word, pagan or polytheistic world where magic has many forms. Now, of course, even in the Roman era, there was debate about what's true religion and what's magic, right? But the early church fathers are, in a sense, kind of joining that same conversation, but with a different set of motivations and purposes and goals. And so very early on, early church fathers like John Chrysostom or Clement of Alexandria are acknowledging all of these kinds of everyday practices that people engage in for everything from protecting their health and bringing about good fortune to securing love interests to trying to gain success of all sorts, right? Some material, some spiritual. And what's really interesting is they don't question this idea that there are powerful forces in the world at play and that human beings desire and need to engineer and influence those sources. What they're interested in is how you do it. So for them, you know, what magic is these inappropriate ways of harnessing supernatural forces. And what makes them inappropriate in this early Christian period and in ways that actually persist throughout Byzantine history or Eastern Roman history is the concern that people are purposely or accidentally turning to demons, to evil forces associated with Satan, or they're turning to forces that aren't Christian because they're associated with other religions. And those can be Eastern religions. Those can be Judaism. It's, you know, a broad range of alternative sources that are considered problematic or unorthodox or unchristian. And so, you know, it's tricky with these terms. We want these terms to be stable. We want magic to mean the same thing in different moments, but it just doesn't. Magic is a term that's often being, one could say, harnessed or even manipulated to serve larger goals. And so magic generally is a term which is used to refer to practices that a particular author, a particular source, wants to argue should be avoided or rejected or condemned because they are not drawing from an orthodox set of practices or beliefs or authorities. And that may sound sort of a little perhaps vague, but it's actually really important to see the use of those terms in a big picture. Because if one wants or expects that you can go to different sources throughout Byzantine history and have those terms mean the same thing, you will get confused very quickly because they do not. And so John Chrysostom is an interesting example because he gives almost, in one source, he gives almost a catalog of all of these things that people do in their everyday lives, from sewing little red threads into their clothing as a protective device, to using amulets to secure, you know, love interests or success or what have you. And he isn't saying that you can't protect yourself or that you can't see wealth and success. What he is saying is you have to use the right kind of emblems, so things like the cross, and also that you should be directing your desires and your interests toward positive, you know, Christian values and goals. And so it's really not that Christianity denies that there's supernatural powers, and Christianity doesn't deny that you have to navigate those powers effectively. It's really how you do it and where you place your trust. What kind of symbols do you employ as a Christian to ensure that you're channeling the correct sources of power. And those, of course, would be God, Christ, the Virgin Mary, the saints. And that's really, you know, where we see something like a consistent definition of what magic is. Magic, in the end, is anything that's considered to be unorthodox or outside of Christian practices.
Yeah. A follow-up question I wanted to ask you is, to what degree, and, you know, please feel free to draw from the whole panoply of history here, to what degree does the accusation of magic overlap or inhabit the same kind of discourse as the accusation of heresy on the one hand, enemy within stuff, right? And the accusation of Jewish practices, which is something Chrysostom was super worked up about as well back in the 4th century, but still remains a problem, right? This idea and the reason I think of the Jews is because I wonder to what degree, you just mentioned God, Jesus, and saints as all legit Orthodox places to go for help in your everyday life. But what about angels, right? And I wonder the degree to which there was a perception that if you're doing that angel stuff, that's Jewish stuff. Just because a lot of the material I've seen from Judaism and also kind of the Solomonic texts, which are kind of like treading a fine line between Jewish and Christian motifs, are just, it's all about angels and demons. Yeah. And you don't see a lot of this angel, you don't see so much directly addressing angels in the East Roman sort of folk tradition.
Well, you do. You do see it in amulets. And I think what you also see is that the Jewish, what we, you know, are kind of conflating is the Jewish tradition. I think in a lot of ways, it's a mistake to conflate the Jewish tradition because there are aspects of the Jewish tradition that the Byzantines embraced fully and even saw as part of their own legacy, right? So, you know, the Old Testament was accepted as a form of truth, not full truth, right? But a form of truth.
Accepted or appropriated, depending on your perspective on that question.
Exactly. Accepted or appropriated. And I think I would probably myself join the appropriated camp. and part of that process of appropriation was a certain practice of selectivity, right? So there's certain passages from the Psalms that become crucial magical incantations and inscriptions that appear on amulets in the early Byzantine period, you know, arguably through the medieval Byzantine period. And this is because it can be very tricky to date some of these objects because there's a fair amount of continuity across time. The Testament of Solomon, right? Solomon is a Jewish king and Solomon becomes a major emblem of imperial authority and power. The Byzantine imperial ideology appropriates him, you know,
Justinian is the second Solomon when he built the Hagia Sophia.
Yes, and Solomon continues to be very important in the Middle Byzantine period for various emperors. So we can't sort of full scale make a claim that the quote unquote Jewish tradition is rejected. But there are aspects of the Jewish tradition that are seen as other or outside of Christianity, and they generally circulate around themes where historical Jewish groups or individuals were enemies, quote unquote, of Christ or rejected Christ as a savior. And so it's very important to make that distinction. And this is because this Testament of Solomon tradition persists, you know, either explicitly or implicitly well into the medieval era and beyond. And so Judaism, you know, is again, it's not quite so simple as saying that Jews and the Jewish tradition were seen as other and to be avoided. There are actually ways in which, as you appropriately put it, that tradition is appropriated actively. And angels are included among the types of powerful figures who are evoked in incantations, who are evoked in prayers. Their names sometimes are repeated. There's a basic principle of late antique and medieval magic, which also continues to the present day, which is this principle of the many names of powerful forces. So one of the principles of incantation is if you're fighting against a demon, you want to name that demon by every name they have, because if you don't use the full range of names, you risk their escaping your control.
Okay.
So naming is very powerful.
So we just saw this very much played out in the Vivlos Sophias to Apollonio and also in the Iromantia of Solomon. It's all about getting the names, both of the demons and the angels.
And the angels, exactly.
That are going to fight the demons.
Right.
And what you're saying is, in broad strokes, this also plays out in the more folky magical tradition. So it's not just your grimoire tradition that has this sort of
not at all.
Concern with getting the right names.
Mm-hmm. So just to give you the material example, one of the things that is done throughout, as far as we can tell, throughout Byzantine history, because we have references to this from the early to the late period, is the writing down of these magical phrases and statements, basically magical, they're incantations, but they're also spells, essentially. And when you write these spells down, you can write them down on paper, You can write them down on different kinds of metal. So lead is very popular, but you also see references to gold and silver being used. And when you write down these spells, you actually have to carry out exactly what these magical treatises say. You have to give all the names. You have to write all the names. And sometimes on amulets, you see more than one name being used as a way to control either a negative or a positive power. It very much manifests in the material record as well.
That's cool. Now, you say, just as a little side note, you mentioned paper. Are you speaking loosely, or do you actually mean paper? Because paper is a technological thing, right, in our period. It's the Arabs know how to make it, and the East Romans don't, but they're sort of buying it from the Arabs.
Yeah, there are examples of talismanic objects in paper in the Islamic era. I don't know offhand the earliest example, but it's definitely the case that that's happening. And the equivalent for paper in the Byzantine, particularly the early Byzantine or early Eastern Roman period, would be papyrus. So,
the
Greek
parchment.
Magical papyri are being produced in papyrus, but papyrus is also used for these little sort of like spells you write on paper, you fold them up, maybe you stick them in your shoe, or you bury them in someone's house, or you put them in a little container that you wear around your neck. One of the interesting things about the spells, and maybe this is getting into also a kind of analogy to the occult, which is that these spells are often intentionally folded up and hidden.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of power that comes from hiding things.
Yeah.
The amulets that you might stick them in, or the little containers, the phylacteria, those are often prescribed to be worn hidden. So there's a real attention and interest of things being buried, right?
Yeah.
This is all part of what empowers things, is the hiding and the folding and the compressing.
And if we want to expand our view a little bit, we can think, okay, we're in the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries going forward into the Middle Ages. What's going on in Mesopotamia at the same time? The incantation bowls, which we have.
A
huge
record
of, only because they're pottery, so they survive. And they're all hidden, right? They're all buried.
Yeah.
And it seems like, I think most scholars of those bowls would agree that the act of burying the bowl, usually upside down, so it's like properly hidden.
Exactly, they're inverted.
Is what empowers it, what kind of activates it. So that's another example of that magical impulse, I guess, to hide the thing
it's
once it's made.
It's the impulse. But it's also part of the ritual. It's part of the mechanics, right? There's a precision to this. This is a skill set. This is a body of knowledge. It's not just about words.
Yeah.
It is also about how you empower the words. And empowering the words involves a lot of very specific manipulation. And it's also a manipulation that's not only spatial and physical, it's also temporal. So you sometimes see in the Greek magical papyri, certain things have to be done certain times of the month, maybe even the year. It has to do with astral bodies and moonlight, and these things matter. So it's a real art, right? It's a technique. It's something that requires knowledge, not just about words and inscriptions, but also about the materials that are going to be most effective, the manipulation of them physically, and how this is all carried out in relationship to time.
Yeah, qualitative time. And it's interesting because, you know, Paul Magdaleno has done a bunch of great research into the East Roman astrological scene. And I refer listeners to his works because he's probably covered 95% of what's available in terms of evidence. It does seem like you had a spectrum from proper Hellenistic astrology with all the bells and whistles, lunar mansions, you name it, you know, and then all the way down to a sort of super folksy astrology that just pays attention to like the cycle of the moon and maybe the zodiac, like a kind of newspaper astrology today, rising sign astrology.
Exactly. That's a great parallel.
And everything in between, right?
Everything in between. And when you get down to these, you know, I'm going to use this kind of vocabulary of like higher and lower, but, you know, I think there are other ways we can think about this, because higher and lower suggests that the well-educated people only did the really esoteric intellectual stuff, and that the lower class people only did this sort of more superstitious, practical, results-driven stuff. And I think we need to always caution ourselves against assuming that this breaks down so fully along socioeconomic, for lack of better words, lines. There's a lot of evidence to indicate that people at higher social echelons were engaging in the same sort of like results-driven, what we might think of as more superstitious practices. But what I do like instead are these ideas more like I just said, results-driven, right? So a lot of magic addresses crises, like people in need, people who are in difficult situations of a whole, you know, range. There's a very strong psychological dimension to a lot of magic, right? How do you address anxiety? How do you quell fear? And it doesn't take much imagination to recognize that people of all socioeconomic levels had anxieties and fear. And magic, right, was one of the ways you address that. And I think, you know, something that we often today kind of split hairs about is whether something was magic or religion. And there are definitely texts that indicate that medieval people also were splitting hairs over this, right? So in the 13th century, Theodore Balsamon, who's one of the really important canon law commentators, so Christian law as opposed to civic imperial law, and he does a fair amount of hair splitting, but that's the genre that he's writing in. It's a hair splitting genre. And, you know, in day-to-day life, when people had a need, they turned to what worked. Saints' lives are really interesting because sometimes when they're advocating for the power of icons or amulets of saints, they'll often mention that the person in need had gone to a doctor and been given all the sort of conventional treatments of herbs or physical manipulation or, you know, heat or cold, and it didn't work. It was only the icon of the saint that worked, right? And so there is a sense that people are, they have a lot of different options at hand. And all of these options, whether it's what we might call today medicine or whether it's these supernatural manipulations, people are desperate and they're turning to a kind of set of possibilities and moving through them to reach what's most effective.
That brings me to something I wanted to ask you about. The description you've just given of magic as, you know, ways to deal with the problems of everyday life that, you know, all the normal non-magical ways have failed, from being sued in the law courts to giving birth in a pre-medicine, modern medicine age, and everything else. That could easily describe what's in the whole corpus of Greco-Roman magical papyri, the PGM. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It's all getting stuff done when potentially when all
results driven.
But what I wonder is there a change overall in our magic now that we are very firmly in a overwhelmingly Christian context? And I think of things like erotic magic, right? So a lot of the PGM spells are about like find such a beautiful boy or such a beautiful woman, inflame her with desire for me and get her like running to me because she like nothing is going to satisfy except me. And then that's the kind of stuff that made people like Chrysostom extremely uncomfortable. Like, this is not Christian magic, right? But we do see a little bit, like in the Coptic papyri, there's a couple erotic spells that are clearly Christian. So do we see, is there anything genre-wise, or like in the sorts of things people are trying to do with their magic, be it talismanic, be it amulets, be it little incantations, whatever, prayers, that have really changed because we are now Christian? In other words, everything from that kind of pre-Christian magical culture that we have a record of from Greco-Roman Egypt, is that all still being done without exception?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to answer those kinds of questions in black and white terms with total confidence. So if you look to the middle Byzantine era, let's say the 9th to 13th century, and you say, I want to see if there's continuity, there's evidence there that there is continuity. So there's saints' lives. There's a saint, Irene, and part of the story of her life is a story of a nun, I believe it's a different nun, who becomes the object of a man's attention. And he engages in exactly the kind of like making maybe waxen figures and, you know, engaging in incantations to drive her, you know, insane with lust for him, right? And this is countered by various saints who appear in visions and undo these, you know, demonic or magical practices. But that, you know, you know, arguably is kind of straight out of the PGM, right? We see exactly that kind of creation of effigies to stimulate sexual desires and attention. And so we have evidence there. Now, it's a saint's life. So is it a historical document recording that there was a man who did this? It's not. I tend to think of saints' lives, or to be in the camp of people who think of saints' lives as having had to have been plausible for their readers in order for people to have confidence in them. But they're not historical treatises of documented events. And that's okay. They don't have to be. And I think what a saint's life like that tells us is that people in that era were inclined to believe that people were engaging in sort of practices, and maybe even new people who did. So the fact that someone was still doing that sort of activity, engaging in that sort of activity in the 9th, 10th, 11th century, is something that is clearly plausible. And then you have a source like Michael Salos, who was himself, he's a very important courtier of the 11th century, probably the best educated person, friend of a podcast. Like Michael Salos is everyone's friend because the guy talked so much and wrote so much. He documents all these things we want to know. And it's dangerous because one person should not speak for an entire civilization, but he does it so well. It's hard not to let him have the microphone a lot. But he was himself someone who engaged in this Hellenic learning of various kinds and also Eastern learning. And for him, this was a mark of the educated person, and he was very defensive about and had strong arguments for why it was necessary for him to dabble in and have some familiarity with these areas of learning that, of course, he acknowledged were also perceived by some to be unorthodox. But he also, I think more interestingly, there's sort of filters into comments that he makes about the Byzantine court, and particularly the Empress Zoe, that make these kinds of insinuations that things she engages in are the results of superstition, and that she's trying to conjure and manipulate forces that are unorthodox. And he downplays it to some degree. Yeah.
Got it. Well, are we talking desidemonia? What is the Greek term that we would translate as superstition here?
Oh, it's a really good question. I'd actually have to go back. I do not know off the top of my head, but I could double check what exactly it is.
Cool. We'll put it in the notes.
He uses more than one term, but it's partly because he's really using a lot of innuendo.
Right.
Right. This is not a sort of like, I will prove that she is engaging in sorcery. It is more sort of like, she does some stuff that's, it's kind of
right
on the edge.
Questionable practices.
Yeah, questionable. And it involves a lot of, hanging stuff on your body to bring about fertility, or treating your boyfriend lover in ways that have these kind of like magical overtones of stuff, whether it's like perfumes. Perfume always had this possible association with different kinds of magical practices. She engages in quite a range of things that are just, outside the norm, I think is Salas's point. And he also really speaks of this as being sort of like silly and ridiculous and evidence of her lack of qualification to rule. Like, this is the sort of thing that a not serious person does. And so it also suggests that he's attempting to diffuse this conversation around magic, right? He wants us not to take her seriously. And he's evoking these kinds of practices as a way to show her as being sort of silly and frivolous.
Mm. That raises a whole fascinating realm of polemic, because a way of contextualizing that debate. And, I'm not trying to say this is the explanation of what Salos is doing there, but one aspect of it might be highly erudite Salos, who has supped at the fount of wisdom of Proclus and other theurgic Platonists, is going to have their critique of lower stroke, quote unquote, lower magic, and be like, yes, like that kind of, what Iamblichus says is standing on charakteres, like that kind of stuff. Yeah. No, we don't do that. That's nonsense. But there is another kind of ritual practice that does work, that is the concern of the educated universal scholar who is trying to ascend to the divine principles. That is known as theurgy. And this dipstick empress just doesn't know anything about that, right? So like a super elite, but you might want to say a critique of magic from within magic, in a certain way.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, first of all, I agree with you completely. I think that's exactly one of the things that's going on. I hesitate, again, to return, although we're both doing it, return to the term magic, because I think that often results in us kind of collapsing all the subtlety that we're attempting to build. But yes, on some level, that is essentially what's happening. And that's a kind of collapsing that isn't just us. You know, there are moments when the Byzantines do that kind of collapsing as well, often for rhetorical purpose or whatever. I want us to just linger a little bit on this issue too about gender, because I think you're right. It's absolutely about the erudite versus the simpleton or the uneducated person. But I think the gender component is also something worth lingering on. And of course, these are very intersectional social identities. Women were, generally speaking, not allowed to pursue education at the same level as men. And in many respects, didn't have access to the kind of education that Michael Salos is, I think you're absolutely right, celebrating himself and a very small circle around him for possessing. But this idea of a kind of, you know, crazy old drunken woman is something that goes back to the early church fathers, and it persists throughout Byzantine history. So there's definitely a kind of gender politics that sometimes filters into these instances of finger pointing about who's reliable and who's not, who's dangerous and who's not, who should just be not taken seriously.
We can push it further back as well, right? With due attention to nuance, because the figure of the female practitioner in fully polytheist Greco-Roman culture, like when Christianity and monotheism aren't even on the horizon, still like the witches of Thessaly, mm-hmm. or, you know, mm-hmm. like you've got mm-hmm. the Magos, who's this male practitioner sure. with a whole, he's scary and he's, you know, borderline mm-hmm. and he's lots of things, mm-hmm. but he's doing something qualitatively different, it seems to me, in a lot of the sources from the witch, you know,
yeah.
witches are yeah. much more kind of these, you'd lump them together in, to put it in modern terms, you'd lump them together with things like vampires and werewolves. Like they're sort of monsters more than
yeah.
humans even.
Yeah, and I think that kind of equivalent idea of a witch in Byzantium, although I'm kind of unsure what exactly the Greek terms for that would be.
Well, like Strix, for example?
There is this, because I don't think they come up as much. I'd have to go back and yeah. look. But I think the thing about the witch is that the witch is usually pretty effective, right? Mm. The witch actually, she's got some power. She is able to make things happen.
Yeah.
And the crazy old woman on the street does not.
That's true.
So the witch is actually not just superstitious. She's dangerous.
Right.
In a way that the, you know, some of these sources that talk about other women, right? So I think you're absolutely right. There are these multiple female types that turn up in this larger discourse on magic. There are a couple of instances where we have these women in the Middle Byzantine period who either individually or in kind of a group are involved in kind of prophecy or claiming to be seers.
Right.
And so maybe that's something a little closer, maybe, to the idea of a witch. Mm. They're usually seen as being ineffectual or somehow connected with really problematic sort of demonic practices. But, you know, I do think that the way that women turn up in sources relating to magic are really important. And I think often the way they're discussed reveals quite a bit about the sort of androcentric world of Byzantium and how it wants to place and often disempower women. Occasionally, though, there are women involved in divisions of magic that are spoken about in pretty even terms, even with respect. So there is an early female alchemist who's credited with an important role in consolidating reliable understanding of alchemy.
Maria,
exactly. Yeah. And, you know, midwives also are a group of women who kind of vacillate back and forth. Some midwives, you know, are these sort of like silly women handing out amulets. But some midwives really are understood to have, you know, sound medical knowledge and play a really important role in the health ecosystem of the Byzantine world. So, you know, it's this gender dimension of magic, you know, broadly defined, is a really interesting one because we do see these different possibilities for how women can be perceived and the kind of roles they're playing in society.
And we shouldn't, in arguing that there is that, I mean, one sign that, we don't, that women really are in a somewhat, despite the anakomnenes of the world, they basically don't have access to education in East Roman culture and don't have access to the overt levers of power. Even though, as we all know, from Theodora onward, there are a lot of very powerful women in East Roman culture. There's no East Roman Hildegard von Bingen. You know what I mean? Right? Like, there might be people taught. There might have been a Hildegard von Bingen, but she's only going to, we're only going to know about her because some bloke wrote a thing about her and said, like, this silly woman in this monastery or in this nunnery is having visions, right? While in Western Europe, somehow her work actually, and then later these 14th century female mystics, their works are written often by them and survive, are transmitted. So that's a difference.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. One thing I would say about the midwives, right? That's a super interesting thing to think about, because in a society that doesn't really have access to medical understanding that's going to make childbirth a non-dangerous situation, right? It's going to be dangerous no matter what, for everyone, always. For the rich, the poor, doesn't matter. You need midwives. That's your best bet, is to have a woman who's seen 50 births, knows what to do if the baby's breech, knows, you know, all the tricks of the trade. And so even if you wanted to be speaking as a man and being, you know, this idea that like male doctors should take over childbirth, that's a much later and, you know, disastrous idea
of the early modern period. Arguably so, yes.
but no one, it seems to me like no one would be crazy enough to be like, we have to get rid of midwives and just women should just give birth, what, on their own or with a Galenic male practitioner? Like, that's not going to make any sense to anyone. So then you're left with, okay, midwives are a thing and we have to. And then you can maybe critique, but this midwife just gave my wife an amulet and that's like, didn't do anything. Or thank God the midwife gave my wife the amulet because it was a very easy birth, you know, like depending on your experience and how many kids you have and whether you have kids and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And there are a lot of, you know, there's just a huge volume of material culture related to women's health and birthing in particular. And
give us some conception. Describe some cool examples of this.